Welcome to Women's Voices. My name is Genevieve Gluck. In this episode, I spoke with Ellie Arrow, a radical feminist and prostitution abolitionist activist. Ellie uses social media to criticize the sex industry, both prostitution and pornography, from a feminist perspective using research, data, and personal stories of women who have been involved in the industry. You can find her on Twitter at Ellie Arrow, that's E-L-L-Y-A-R-R-O-W, as well as on YouTube, and read more of her work on WordPress at elliearrow.wordpress.com.
Hey everyone, and thank you for having me. So I'm Ellie, I go by Ellie Arrow online. You can find me on various social media, especially Twitter, but I also have a YouTube channel. And I've been looking into the subject of mostly prostitution, but since they intersect, also pornography, for about, it's been almost 6 years now. So since I left high school, basically, because I am from a country where we have a liberalized prostitution policy. Germany famously has lots of legal brothels. And it's one of these subjects, once you start looking into it, you cannot look away again. Like, it'll just stay with you, and you can either start doing something about it or kind of despair for humanity. And unfortunately, I'm not exaggerating when I say that. And as some might know, Germany used to be celebrated for its prostitution policy as, you know, progressive and open and sex positive. And we no longer are. We have now have a quite a terrible reputation internationally. And I'm sure we'll go into all of that.
Let's get some background on the decriminalization of basically sex trafficking in Germany. So what were the circumstances that led to that? When did that happen and why?
Yes, I should probably clarify this. Some terms that float around in this conversation that are quite confusing. Some people say it's legalization. Some people say it's decriminalization. And then what do these mean? There is a, for those people who are interested, there's a whole report by the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women that compares Germany, which I'll go into, and New Zealand, which I won't go into much now because it's too much to cover in one interview. But it's often said that Germany legalized prostitution and put all these rules on it and lots of state intervention. But New Zealand is really the good model, and they figured it out. And actually, the state needs to be more hands-off because when the state interferes, it's always... it always ends up harming women. And they have a little bit of a case there, but the reality is these laws are very, very similar. So things that I will be describing for Germany, most of them absolutely also apply to New Zealand. And if those people who want to know the details, they can find all of that out in that report. So what happened in Germany? Many people say we legalized prostitution in 2002. That's not accurate. Prostitution, or many aspects of it, have basically always been legal for as long as we have recorded history. We have today what is Germany used to be part of the Roman Empire. They had brothels famously. Then we had them in the Middle Ages, lots of records. And we had a gigantic brothel network in all territories occupied by the Nazis. It's really frustrating that people have forgotten this history. They like to say prostitution, you know, is the oldest profession. But then when you look at these historic mechanisms, most of the time, it's really just sexual slavery. And the only thing that's always been allowed are the group of people. But we know historically, the women have been forced to get medical exams. They've been arrested. But then at the same time, there's this mentality, oh, we need this industry because men need it, right? That's been very, very strong in Germany, and we've yet to break through that. And the thing that happened in 2002 was just that our legal code finally decided we're going to be slightly less hypocritical and actually admit that this is how we view prostitution, that we feel like it's just a business that we need to keep around. And if we're going to do it, then might as well tax it. Maybe that'll actually benefit women a little bit. And this is how the policy was advertised abroad, and many people celebrated it when it happened, but it's difficult to summarize what actually happened on the ground, but I'll try to keep it brief. So the policy clarified that you're allowed to maintain a brothel. It was kind of legal before, but now it's clear. You may profit from the prostitution of other people. This is what most people understand as pimping. But we now distinguish between exploitative pimping and legal pimping. And it's no surprise that this policy was lobbied for by brothel keepers. And that's no secret. There are literally photos of our lawmakers and famous escort agency owners drinking champagne together. So not a conspiracy, this is a fact. And they said it'll benefit women because now they can have employment contracts. But in practice, most women are independent contractors. Very few actually sign a contract. They feel like it would give the brothel owner too much power over them. Most are just in prostitution briefly. They don't want to tie their identity and their legal papers to it. Same thing, they said, if you pay taxes, you'll get social security and health benefits. Nearly nobody has registered as a prostitute. When women do register, they register as private entertainers. Anything to keep the stigma off and to try and not have third parties control you, though in practice, they still have many ways of doing that. And then supposedly women can now sue sex buyers for non-payment. The thing is, the way that the sex trade actually works is he always pays upfront, because we know throughout history, one of the most dangerous situations is when the sex buyer is dissatisfied with the service of the woman, and then they fight over payment. So she always gets the money upfront. So these new things that were supposed to help women, they had no practical use, because it's not how the sex industry works. This law was written with the assumption, you know, women make a choice and they have control. And these are two consenting adults meeting on eye level, and the way the industry really works, these are not applicable, these are not helpful. But what it did do is give, like I said, legitimized brothel owners, it gave them the power to prescribe shift times, locations, mandate nudity, tell women what prices to put on their so-called services, and the state is getting lots and lots of taxes. So that's the basics of what the law did. It's a little bit of a long monologue, but there's so much that you just hear, oh, women can, you know, they pay taxes and now they get security. And it's like, there's this whole, like an iceberg, all this under the water that you're not hearing or you're not seeing. But there was an excellent doctoral thesis by a social science researcher who just went into all of this for the German speaking audience. I can provide that source so you can read it. She looked at all these numbers. So things I'm telling you are all backed up by data. Okay, so what happened as a consequence of this law, not only did it not achieve its goals, it had a lot of unintended effects. And people who want to have something like the German model really need to know about these. It's, for example, the concept of consent in this law is basically you're only not consenting if you're being basically like physically beaten to go to the brothel. But you can still be considered a consenting prostitute if you're homeless, addicted, don't have legal residence. You're really only legally now a victim of pimping if, like I said, you're being beaten or you've been physically threatened or you're being told to perform specific sex acts on specific men. So there are victims in courts trying to sue their traffickers, but the trafficker said, oh, but I never made her, you know, have anal sex with customer X. Like, I just rented this room to her and I might have been a little bit pushy. And it is the police and the courts themselves are telling us it's getting harder to prosecute traffickers as a direct consequence of this law. And on the other side, the sex buyer that we like to forget about, as a consequence of this law, he is not held to account for anything that the women suffer. So unless he has basically murdered her, I'm not exaggerating, it was not a crime to pay a woman who was trafficked, which is raping a woman who was trafficked for money. Because the idea is he is a client, and a client, this, like if I go to a nail salon, I get my nails done, and the lady who does it is trafficked, which happens sometimes, then I cannot be held responsible because how could I tell? And they're saying that is the same thing as putting my penis in a woman and not realizing that she doesn't want that. Like, these are the same thing. That's how the law works. Getting my nails done and touching or penetrating a person, these are the same thing. So the client cannot be held to account. And so the whole culture around sex bias basically exploded. It's completely normalized to go to brothels on a business conference, on a business trip. We got lots of sex tourism. We got bachelor parties, 18th birthdays, concerts, very depressing history of parts of the LGBT movement, also using brothels as rooms for parties or pride events. We have grooming of vulnerable people because as soon as it's a job, it's much easier to tell someone, look, once you're 18, this is a job. So why not start a few months early? You know, that's what survivors of child trafficking have told us. Their abusers use this law to legitimize themselves. And we got new degrading business models like flat rates. So that's when the sex buyer pays one price and he can use as many women as he wants, which is the woman doesn't earn more money, just the brothel does. And it's incredibly physically taxing for women to endure that, just man after man after man in these brothels, which is why they're now illegal. That's how bad it was. So because it's now legal to run a brothel, anyone who can gets in on the business. And like I said, you have more men paying because it just becomes even more normalized. Like now you don't have to do it in secret. You can do it openly. You can walk in the front door. Many men still want to go in the back door, but you can now come in the front door. And there are all these new business models coming up. And the same thing happened in New Zealand. They found new ways, the same way that capitalism sells anything else, like a quick sale or a reduced price, or you can buy a sausage and you can have a woman with it. And we heard now during COVID in Austria, which is quite similar to Germany, they had, you can get vaccinated and as a reward, you can get a woman. Like all these business models spring up from just the normalized culture of sex buying. And one of the central ones that survivors of prostitution told us made their life so much harder was the flat rates. Is when he pays something like maybe 70, 80 euros and they don't go to the woman, they go to the brothel. She gets a fixed daily pay. But he just pays once and then he can take as many women to a private room and do what he wants as often as he physically can. And the reporting on this was so incredibly voyeuristic. It was on these business models, it's really depressing that the media also doesn't do its job. It tells it like it's a titillating tale. But at some point they were having trouble reporting on these flat rates, like it's a cute thing, but look at these men, haha, after two women, they're exhausted. The man is exhausted. What is it like for the woman? It's man after man after man after man. There are reports of women physically and emotionally breaking down from these practices. Like when they first started in one mega brothel, there were men queuing outside the brothel. That's how many men came for this offer. And then at the end of the day, the journalists themselves were reporting that women were so sore that they were crying. And I mean, might sound like an extreme example, but all of this is legal. All of this is consenting adults doing what they want in their private time. So that's what a flat rate is. And there's many more. I feel like some of these might not need such detailed explaining. Gangbang, a lot of people know this term now from pornography. So that's one woman and then a group of men that can be between 15 and 30 men. I'm not exaggerating. We had the sale of pregnant women. We also had gangbangs with pregnant women because there's no maternity protections in prostitution. Nor is there health and safety applied. I think we'll talk about that again later. And we also have sex buyers filming women during these so they can keep a private video of all the things they do in brothels.
It's legal for them to film?
Well, I guess technically they need to obtain consent, but since consent means nothing, unless she's got a gun to her head, she's considered consenting. It's to get the extra yes for the video. And some men also film women secretly, of course. And then also there are video cameras in brothels. And like I said, the brothel owner may mandate nudity. So there is already camera footage of her walking around naked in the brothel, and the security has it. And I'm sorry to say, a lot of brothel security overlaps with organized crime. That's the fact. We know that bouncers at clubs sometimes are from this milieu as well. Of course, in brothels, they are. In Germany, it's often the Hell's Angels or the United Tribunes. Now, they have this footage as well, and so do many sex buyers. And that's supposed to be an environment where a woman asserts her sexuality. It's complete upside down once you look at the reality on the ground. And to top it off, more competition means women also make less money. Women in Germany are earning less over the years. And there's also a problem for brothels to even meet the demand for so many women. And the way to fill the empty spots is trafficking. We know that because we have legal brothel after legal brothel or escort agency getting busted for it. And yeah, that's basically how we became known as the Brothel of Europe. And I think we deserve that name considering that's what happened.
And a lot of these women are migrant women from Romania, isn't that right?
Yeah, so the idea was with the law that we would also get some insight and like some visibility. People say, you know, when it's underground, it's awful. When it comes above ground, it's kind of tolerable. Not only is that evidently not true, we also didn't have any data until in 2017, we decided, okay, we are actually going to make women register with the government, which has some negative effects on them because the ones who don't register are then criminalized. But at least we have data a little bit, and we know 81% of the registered women are migrants, and we have more Romanian women than German. So you might not believe me when I say there's a lot of trafficking, but that alone is proof. It's at the very least driven by poverty. And I always say, if the landlord can't go up to a woman and demand sex when she can't pay rent, like, why can the sex buyer? How's that any different? And our own government is at the stage where in 2017, they said, okay, we actually recognize prostitution is very often not a choice. So together with this mandatory registry, we now have mandatory counseling where they try and talk about health matters as well as try and ascertain who is and isn't trafficked. But there are many ways around that for traffickers. And they also decided to illegalize these practices that I talked about earlier, like flat rates, because they got bad press. Like, in my opinion, I feel a bit cynical. I don't trust that my government or that many people in my government really care about women. It's because it is bad for our country's reputation at this stage with what's happening and the amount of attention on it. And they also finally mandated condoms. So that's on top of everything. Men didn't even have to use condoms in German prostitution until 2017. But how do you check if they do? Because they're alone with a woman in the room. He just pays some extra. He can still get it without a condom. And also, we finally criminalized raping trafficking victims, but we have had not a single conviction. So these laws are really so toothless. Just the attempt of separating prostitution into voluntary and involuntary, good health measures, bad health measures, it just does not work at all. And then also during the pandemic, legalization turned back into prohibition. Suddenly it was illegal to sell sex, but we had no programs and no safe houses to send women to, the many women who became homeless or became dependent on brothel owners for shelter or had to keep selling and risk infection with COVID while also being treated as criminals. Like, it's a complete scandal. And I was really upset that there was a little bit of reporting, but most of it was like, let's just reopen brothels anyway. That would be the merciful thing to do for women rather than say, no one should have to risk getting COVID to survive. That includes women in prostitution. Can't we give them something else than sending them back to the brothel? But we don't have a support infrastructure because we've been claiming so long that it's just the job. So we really, really let women down during the pandemic. And then my final point, just this year, you know, we're getting a new government, and shortly before the switch of power from the old administration to the new, they decided they will invest slightly more money, but only for children, exploited children, and pregnant women. So they're again dividing. These are victims and these women, not really. You have to always prove your vulnerability to deserve support. That's one of the most frustrating things in our system. And they're trying to make it a little bit easier to prosecute sex buyers of trafficking victims, as in they're, what's the legal term, reversing the, it's not that the court has to prove that he knew about the trafficking, he has to prove that he didn't know about it, the reversal of burden of proof, something like that. But we still have no sentences. So a terrible law, then some toothless adjustments, and really, really horrible outcomes that at this stage, nobody, not the German government, not even the pro-prostitution lobby, is denying.
Something that always astonishes me about when you try to have this conversation with someone, let's say, who's kind of new to it, right? There tends to be that immediate defense about choice, the choice rhetoric that we hear so much about. You can give people statistics about, you know, the amount of grooming of children into the industry, sexual abuse, the statistics of the women who want to exit. And yet for the tiny percentage of these hypothetical women who love this and enjoy doing it, we're sacrificing the 99% or whatever the case may be there. So I wondered if I could get your take on how you would respond to someone bringing up the argument of choice.
I mean, I do talk about the statistics, like where do women actually come from? What's actually their demographic? What's actually the demographic makeup, which shows you the number who can, by circumstance, reasonably, truly, freely have chosen it must be minuscule. But I actually also, I've written a whole blog post on this for those who are interested, which is, I think, the myth of the happy high-class hooker. I don't usually use that term, but it's used by the media. So that's why I'm referring to it that way. Because if you look at a lot of these stories of the women who make a lot of money, who have been publicly presented as sort of the pinnacle of the sex trade, the success story, you actually find a lot of darkness in their histories as well. One of the most famous women in German history in prostitution, her name was Rosemarie Nitribitt. And like there's movies about her and musicals about her. And she's like sort of our pretty woman story, though she never married a rich man. She was known for moving in these powerful circles around politicians and these rich business owners and rich heirs, and they wrote her love letters. And she was really a very intelligent woman. She spoke multiple languages, right? So she was cultured too, even though she had not undergone a classic education, etc. She did have a lot of intelligence and wit, and I think that's what a lot of people want to associate with the successful prostitute. But then you look a little bit closer in her history, and she actually lost her mother. She was taken away from her mother when she was very young. She was raped when she was just 12, 13 years old. She was then groomed and sold to be raped as a child to the soldiers in the town where her adoptive parents lived. Like, she has this terrible backstory that people later uncovered after she got famous. And then actually she was murdered just a few years into this like high class prostitution. And to this day, we don't know who killed her, and it could have been the police like covered up most of what happened to her, which makes people suspect that it must have been someone powerful. So I wrote a whole blog post about her, and she's not a sort of outlier. There's a lot of stories of so-called high class successful women who have similar stories. They're among the murdered too. I always say that you even have like dominatrixes with their own studios, no contact dominatrixes, because you know some of them are also prostituted, but some are not, and they get murdered by a long-term client. So even the women who look really glamorous on the outside, very often that's not the case. So I don't like pointing at them saying, look, these privileged women are ruining it for the trafficked women down below. There is no such thing as a truly privileged woman in prostitution, in my opinion, and we need to let go of that glamorized image.
All right. So speaking of that image of the glamorized prostitute and how unrealistic it is, let's talk about how women typically enter the sex industry in the first place. So we kind of touched on this just briefly earlier about the trafficking and the grooming. But in general, what is the pattern for women who end up in the sex industry?
Yeah. So we don't know this with absolute certainty because there aren't enough statistics. So I'm just bringing together a little bit of data and a lot of what women themselves have said. And for the biggest group, certainly of German women, it's falling through the social security net, or it's not getting enough benefits as a disabled woman. And I think that's common around the globe. So we like to think, especially with countries like Germany, that there's a safety net. No one's going to fall through it. Like, we're all being taken care of, right? People even say Germany is a nanny state, and these kinds of things, but it's not true at all. It's actually not that rare that people fall through the safety net and end up suddenly without income. So they can't pay rent. They can't pay electricity. Some don't have food. And what is a job that you can enter, so-called job you can enter instantly with zero qualification? Well, it's prostitution. Anyone, especially a woman or a young woman, can just enter that quite quickly. So that's how a lot of women slip into it, as a way to just pay bills. And many of them, it's seen as a temporary solution, and they want to get out as fast as they can. But many get stuck, because then prostitution itself, you can become indebted while you're in there. You owe the brothel owner money for the room. You owe the advertiser money for something. You become entangled. And there are, you also have both women who enter the sex trade because they have an addiction and they lose their job. So they lose their social connections, etc. And you have women getting addicted while they're in prostitution just to bear the daily realities. Every single woman I know who is a sex trade survivor has either has been in an environment with drugs and alcohol, just completely normalized. There are many, many university students who cannot afford their studies. I really hate it when both the media and sex buyers say, oh, but she's a university student, therefore it's a choice. I'd say exactly the opposite. There are really poor university students. I don't know why we suddenly forget that when we talk about prostitution. They want to get an education. They cannot afford it. They're not getting enough help from the government. Prostitution seems like it could fix that, but it comes, as we know, with a terrible cost for many. And then we have the huge number of migrant women, and they come from the poorest parts, often of Eastern Europe. And I'm not sure that people understand really how poor these regions are. Some of them don't have like water and electricity. Like, that's how bad the poverty is. Like, people keep saying, oh, those Romanians should just stay home. You know, all these anti-migrants, they're just greedy. They want to get a piece of the German economy. A lot of these women come from nothing. Some of them have not finished high school. We have a significant number of illiterate women in the German sex trade, so much that, you know, outreach NGOs are having to find ways to communicate with these women because they can't give them a pamphlet. They cannot read. These women are brought, some of them do come on their by themselves, but driven by poverty. In my opinion, poverty is a pimp. Some are brought in by deception. They'll be told you'll be a nanny or a cleaner or something. And then it's actually the brothel, but now you have to pay the debt for the traveling, right? The trafficking. And then some are literally, I mean, you do sometimes have the case of a woman kidnapped, but usually it's fraud or nonviolent coercion. Because like I said, as long as she doesn't have bruises on her body, it's much harder to prosecute the pimp. So that's, they find other ways of doing it. And one way they do it that's received tons of media attention, because it's a fact that a lot of teenagers, but it can totally happen to an adult woman, is the lover boy method, which is when the man pretends, you know, we'll go to Germany together and we'll have this great future. And, you know, we'll have children together and a house and a dog. And, oh, but honey, I just, you know, I just can't find a job. Can you just help me pay my debts? And, you know, I have a friend and he runs a business. And then it's modeling, and then it's actually nude modeling, and then it's just a brothel. And it's very, very hard to break women out of these situations, same as it is in domestic violence, because they think they're in love and these men are in love with them.
The lover boy model, is that found in the organized crime? Is that an aspect of the organized crime?
It's both used by organized crime and just individual men. And some of, so it's, sometimes it's really like a member of the Hell's Angels, and sometimes it's just an individual scumbag, or maybe him and a few friends. So these criminal networks can take different proportions. And then, yeah, the final aspect, it's, we do have data from on this from the German Family Ministry. it's not a stereotype that a majority of women in the sex trade are survivors of some kind of neglect or trauma or violence in childhood or young adulthood. I know it seems like a tired trope, but it's unfortunately just a fact. Like, if you have been primed in your life that your boundaries don't matter, your sexuality doesn't matter, as a woman, you're just, the only thing you're good for is sex or being used by men, then this will make you extra vulnerable and make it much harder for you to realize that you are being exploited if that's what you, that has been happening to you in some form since sometimes you were a small child.
Yeah, I kind of want to talk a little bit more about that grooming aspect for a second, because Gail Dines, who, by the way, is a radical feminist researcher who wrote a book called Pornland, but she had talked about having a situation where she was speaking with a convicted sex offender. And he said that he didn't have to do much grooming at all because the culture did the grooming for him. And, you know, that's a big concern of mine these days, especially with, you know, social media, OnlyFans, children having access to pornography at such a young age, which I think all of that plays into the grooming of women to go into the sex industry. It's not so much a question for you, Ellie, I'm sorry, I guess, but it was just sort of a comment from me there that perhaps even the element of neglect and violence doesn't always even have to be so overt or even physical as well. I mean, there's a lot of coercion that goes on just from society and from media. And like you said, you brought up the point about boundaries, being raised to believe that you don't have a right to boundaries, or that giving up your boundaries will make you valued as a person, I think is something that is really worth mentioning or pointing out. So let's talk about the physical impact on women's health when they're involved in the sex industry. So you have an excellent blog post detailing some of these effects on their body. Could you explain?
Yes, absolutely. This is something I worked on recently, and I learned a lot of new things in the process of it, because I'm not a medical professional, but I am in touch with one of the gynecologists whose report this my blog post is also based on. So anyone who's interested to know more, I can actually talk to an expert who can elaborate if anyone has questions. But one of the things I also did to research this, just to preface it before I go into it, is literally just read the so-called sex work guidelines of pro-prostitution organizations. I can only recommend to anyone, read their literature, and that's all you need to, I think chances are it will shake your belief that prostitution is a job like any other, because really some of the worst facts that I give in the blog post come from their literature. There are many, many things associated with prostitution, and it's, you know, we do hear about things like women getting murdered, and I'm not even talking about the worst things that is on the list. You are at risk of being murdered literally by often your customer or your boss. We do have a study in Germany where they traced hundreds of cases, so we know that that is a statistic fact, but it doesn't even, we don't even have to go into that level of darkness. If we just look at the sort of everyday pains of women, well, literally starting with pain, if you have to give lots of hand jobs every day, literally like your hand and your wrist will start to hurt. So people say, oh, that happens to other people who carry boxes or people who work in retail. Yes, but what does it mean when men are using women's bodies and they're in pain? Like, we're literally having women get all kinds of joint pain on their hands, on their jaws, on their knees, so that men can get pleasure. So just, I know we can have a whole argument about, do we need Amazon warehouses? And yes, there are many industries that are unethical and that we need to revise, but literally what the sex industry produces is male orgasms. And the things I'm going to list, we're all accepting that these are done to women's bodies, literally just for men's orgasms, which I think is pretty extreme. There are a lot of women who have back pain, and that's literally from having just heavy men on top of you. Just, it's not even, we're not even talking about violence. We're just talking about what happens to your body when there are lots and lots of men on top of you and inside you. That has effects on women who have to do that day in, day out. There are a lot of injuries you can get during this time. We know that there's a disproportionate number of head injuries in prostitution. These do happen often from physical violence, but there's also, I guess, the injuries that are unique to prostitution are the ones that happen to your vagina and your anus. There's no way to say this without being explicit. You can get tears and fissures and infections in those areas. And that does not happen in any other job. No other job happens inside your body. That is the unique risk that completely violates any kind of, you know, workers' rights and health and safety laws, et cetera. But those happen to women in prostitution. So for example, women will use, some sex work guidelines will tell you to use numbing sprays. You can use them on your mouth if you get pain from blowjobs, or you can use them on your vagina if you are, so not just lube, but actually a numbing spray so that you won't feel your vulva or vagina when it's being literally overexerted. And I have really no idea how anyone can speak of sex positivity when these kinds of things are happening to women. Famously, women can get STIs in the sex trade. In any other job, if you were handling bodily fluids, you'd be wearing goggles and gloves and masks and all these things. In prostitution, you may have literally no barrier, a condom at best. And there are many STIs where condoms don't protect you from. I think Gail Dines talks about this. If you ejaculate in a woman's face, you can get gonorrhea by having semen and eyes touch. So that's part of sex work guidelines, telling you to not, maybe try not to get semen in your eyes. Because only in prostitution will you have direct contact with, well, not just sweat and saliva, but semen and blood. And a number of men want to also, I don't even know why that's still a sex act, but they find it arousing, so we call it sex. There's things to do with urine and feces. So some men we know want to have women pee on them, but there are men who want women to drink their urine. This is according to a New Zealand sex work guide saying, look, be careful drinking men's urine because that might be a request you get. Some men also want to defecate on women or have women eat their feces. This is extreme, but it does happen, and there is no law against it. So I really, sometimes these are the things that do make me speechless. Moving on, I know that's already very heavy stuff. Prostitution is the only job that can get you pregnant. And obviously that'll very likely be unplanned and unwanted because of course women take contraceptives, which in of themselves have side effects, but they will disproportionately often fail because if you're under stress, if you got gastrointestinal issues, which you can also get from brutal anal sex or just you can get from all kinds of things in your environment, your contraception is unfortunately quite likely to fail. So a number of women end up pregnant, and then they might have to get an abortion. So what other job would put you in the situation where you have to make such a personal and painful decision as, am I going to keep this child? Will they take it away from me? Because everyone talks about children being supposedly disproportionately removed from women in Sweden. We have so many cases of this happening in Germany and nobody talks about it. And I can't tell which woman, like where a child does need to be removed and where it doesn't. That's, I'm not an expert on that. I think if a woman is pregnant, we need to help her out of prostitution right then and there so that she can heal, she can think about it, she can make the choice to be a mother or not be a mother in a safe environment. But we don't have programs like that. And then I already mentioned, of course, violence is a risk, and it very often happens. It is very often committed by the sex buyer, and literally right after he has paid and he feels entitled to her body and something goes wrong, men attack women physically because they have erection problems. It's just, I mean, the real reason they attack women is misogyny, but they will take literally any excuse to take it out on women. And I have a whole blog post on this, so I'm not going to go into all of it here, but in the worst case, you might get, in the lighter case, you would just get a bit slapped about, which is serious enough. In the worst case, men have used like erection issues as a justification for strangling women to death. And it's no surprise if you're in an environment like that, your mental health will suffer. Yeah, anyone in that situation would. Like, we hear that women in prostitution have PTSD rates on a similar level to soldiers. And that makes perfect sense once you consider that many women who, when they go to work, they're not sure if they're going to come home alive, or they're not sure if they're going to come home and maybe have a dangerous disease or have an injury, et cetera. So if that's the mentality you go out into your job with, how would you not get PTSD, really? And how would you do it sober? So like I said, the presence of drugs and alcohol is massive. It's quite normalized in the brothel. You can get basically any drug you want. Sometimes the sex buyers bring it in and they want to have chem sex and all that kind of stuff. And it's not an environment that encourages you to take care of yourself. The brothel owner just cares about profit maximization. The John cares about getting maximum fun for minimal payment. Meanwhile, women are trying to stay healthy, but they're literally fighting the environment they're in, which does not care, or whose interest is just diametrically opposed to their own.
Recently, you pointed to an example of a woman who was murdered in the sex industry named Andrea Corzine. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Can you tell us about her case?
Yes. So, her name is Andrea Corzine, and she was a 19-year-old woman who was murdered in prostitution. And the reason that I'm mentioning her case is because this was actually widely reported by the media. Whenever the media reports on prostitution murders, I'm really frustrated. They make it look like isolated cases. Unfortunately, they did with this one as well. There have been about 150 women murdered that we know of. There are no official statistics since 2002, since that liberalized law. And she's one of the most recent cases. And because she was so young and her story is so horrific, that it got this kind of media exposure. So she was 19 years old. She was the mom of two children, and she had lost custody. So again, why are we not talking about women like her losing custody? And she was suffering from schizophrenia. So, and she was exploited by pimps since the age of 17 and sold to sex buyers over and over and over again in legal brothels and possibly illegal ones too. It's hard to distinguish. And when she got especially sick, her old pimp sold her to a new pimp for literally 2,000 euros. This is literal slavery. But just consider, there's a 2-year span and she's getting paid to be raped by all these men. No one reports it. No one calls the cops. The brothels owners don't, the buyers don't think, someone must have noticed something. She was so ill. And her abusers themselves later reported she was so ill that, you know, she would throw food around. She would physically fight people, which is a completely understandable extreme trauma response or response to extreme trauma. So the new pimps figured, oh no, actually this woman is too difficult, but now, what do we do with her now? We've made this investment. Someone's going to notice because we've made her so sick, someone's going to notice something. So they decided to murder her. And then the big scandal in the media was they were showing this photo, right? Everyone was upset because she's so young and this is so terrible. Her first pimp got a sentence of 4.5 years in prison, and his accomplice literally got a year and a half probation. So that's what you get for sexually enslaving a woman. 4 or 5 years and probation. So how is that going to scare anyone off from committing these kinds of crimes? That's a slap on the wrist. Because I should say at this point that I completely agree with many people who criticize prisons, that there are tons of people in prison who shouldn't be for nonviolent offenses. We know that women are in prison because they defended themselves against their abusers. I completely agree with all these things, but there are some violent offenders, some men who are so dangerous. When you let him out of prison, he's going to do it again. And we know this. And I am quite certain this would be one of those cases. And then the people who actually murdered Andrea, they got 8 years, 4 years, and 3 years, respectively. These are really, really laughable sentences. And the the German prostitution survival movement was really hurt over this. So they're saying, like, if you kill one of us, this is the result. These are laughable sentences. Not that you can actually put a value on human life. Obviously, you can't, but still. And these people are going to be good. They got to be out for good behavior and in shorter than that. So this really communicates to pimps, you can do what you want, and then you might go away a few years, or you just might get probation. And we just wonder how many more cases like these do there have to be until we realize that the system is broken. Because this whole rhetoric of, oh, but sex buyers, they want to have consenting women, so when they see someone in distress, they'll call the police, right? That they'll give an anonymous tip, at least. If they're worried about being prosecuted for rape, they might give an anonymous tip. It's not happening. This is not happening. Sex buyers as a group, there might be individuals who do, but as a group, they don't care. Or someone would have intervened and Andrea would still be alive.
That's a really tragic story. And unfortunately, usually it has to be a very extreme and tragic story to make the press, especially international press. One thing that I am curious about, though, that I do think doesn't get talked about enough, or there seems to be a lack of willingness to do any kind of in-depth research on as well. I mean, like so many aspects of this issue, to be honest, but is the impact on women who are not even within the industry itself. So the general public opinion about women shifts. I mean, it's got to, like I said, there's not that much research that I'm aware of on the topic. I did see something related to the investigation by the Swedish government, but that was in the 90s, where when they shifted the law, by the way, I'm referring to what's usually called the Nordic model. So when Sweden adopted what's referred to as the Nordic model, they punished the purchase of sex, which would be the pimps and the punters would be criminalized, but the woman would not be criminalized. And what they found was that implementing this law shifted attitudes towards women in general to such an extent that actually domestic violence had decreased. And so, yeah, you have these knock-on effects as well. Not only the horrific conditions of women within the industry, but the knock-on effect for women in general, because we know that even if one woman is for sale, if a man can purchase a woman, any woman, then that extends to all of us. We would all be treated as a potential commodity or product in the eyes of men. So, and then also you would have the men who are acting out their violent fantasies on women and paying to do it, going home, possibly to a wife or a girlfriend, and then being emboldened to act those things out. I wonder if you have any comments on that. I had a personal experience of this, actually, when I was living in Korea myself. I was with a few friends having some drinks. They were saying, let's go over here. They took me basically to the red light district of that area. And I hadn't realized that was the plan, where they have women trafficked and what's called window girls. So these are also known in, I think, Amsterdam as well, right? Isn't that right? Yeah. So basically, you can imagine the woman kind of for sale in the window, like she's a piece of meat. And I started to feel uncomfortable, and I said so. And one of the men I was with, who was very drunk, he grabbed me, opened the door, and shoved me inside and held the door shut and was saying to me, "You're all the same. You're all the same. You're no different from her." And that moment for me was really, really eye-opening. I mean, I'm never going to forget that experience at all, ever. So I just wanted to share that with you as a personal example of something that, I mean, a quite literal example of how just having this situation, this industry set up, allows men to view all women as a potential piece of property.
I absolutely agree. And your story is quite upsetting, but unfortunately, it's not the first time that I heard something like this. I know a lot of women and girls, because it absolutely extends to girls. We all know girls get sexualized from the moment they start growing breasts. So it's not like men start doing this at 18. For example, I had a host sister from China, and she did a school trip to Amsterdam. And of course, they take them through the red light district because it's a tourist attraction. It's a little curiosity. And she was literally approached by probably a pimp, a Chinese speaking man. He was like, do you want a job? And she was 16. And she was thankfully, you know, not needing cash, and she was not vulnerable, and there were other people around. But if he had gotten her in a different situation, then, but just the fact that they just casually approach you on the street, because it's not a crime. Him profiting off of her as long as she was 18 would be perfectly fine. And, but it happens in so many settings. It's happened to a lot of my friends who work in like service jobs as waitresses or as, it's called, I think it's also called something like a hostess, but it's not the same thing as in Japan, where you are paid to have drinks and flirt, and sometimes it overlaps with prostitution. In Germany, you're like, you have to wear nice clothes, and it does have a little bit of that air about it. And it, at like business conferences, your job is to show the business men and women around the conference hall and the different exhibits and stuff. And you take people's codes and you bring them coffee and that kind of slightly old fashioned thing that we still have. And it's usually done by women. They get approached by these, you know, business men all the time for paid sex. And this is how some slip into prostitution. You just get asked so many times, well, you're probably not getting paid well, but you're so, you know, you're so attractive, and why don't you come to the hotel room with me afterwards? That's completely normalized. Women in service positions are just up for grabs in the minds of a lot of men, and it's not illegal for him to ask. It's an offer of, you know, exchanging money and a service. And I guess the most extreme example from my circle of friends is a friend of mine who is temporarily homeless. Like I said, in the eyes of German law, even if you're homeless, you can still consent to prostitution. And she was living in a hostel and scraping by. And then a taxi driver, and she was like 18, 19, so, and she looked young too. And a taxi driver literally said, you know, I'll pay your hostel for a few nights if you let me come to your room. And she was upset, and she turned him down, and she ran away. And thankfully, she's got permanent housing today. But he wasn't committing a crime. She was over 18. Nothing else basically matters. Men feel incredibly brazen to do these kinds of things. And I guess the other thing I'd point out is the racialized aspect of it, because I'm not, that's another reason why it's so upsetting for me when people who claim to be anti-racism can be prostitution and pornography. We know that porn has all these horrific stereotypes, you know, about Black women and Black men too, about Asian women as submissive. Prostitution is full of that, like advertisings of women from different countries based on the most horrific racist stereotypes. And this has ripple effects. Like if you keep seeing either in porn and or prostitution, women from a certain background presented in a certain way, especially the sexual submissiveness supposedly of Asian women and of Eastern European women, juxtaposed with the, you know, Western European woman who is a feminist bitch in the eyes of these men, and they'll quite freely say so amongst themselves on their disgusting forums. This has ripple effects on any woman from that background who meets a man who has these kind of mental frames around women of her background. And there are sex buyers who said, I can't even hear the Eastern European accent without getting aroused, because to me, I feel like I'm in a brothel. So what does that mean for any woman who meets a man like in a business setting? Can he even take her seriously when his ideas, you know, the women from your country, they're just a bunch of whores? And just to clarify, whenever I'm using these words, I'm using them because this is what the men would use. Obviously, I don't endorse these terms. How can that not have ripple effects on society? And I guess the very last one that has been, I think, mostly in the English-speaking media in regards to Holbeck, Leeds, where they had a decriminalized zone where men could pick up women for prostitution without consequences. They've now shut it down because of the terrible ripple effects for the people who live there, and especially the women and girls. You have to imagine, not all, but many parts of Germany, because the laws vary slightly by region. In Germany, we have like many, many, many Holbecks, basically. These areas where street prostitution is super prevalent or where there's many brothels, for the female residents, that's just constant harassment. Going to school, coming back home from work, getting asked, what's your price, honey? How much for you? the kids growing up, especially girls, having to see these semi-nude advertisements everywhere, how is that not gonna mess with you? How's that not gonna, like, we already know women and girls internalize this from pop culture, but what if you live in that part of town? You're gonna have people make jokes about you, you know? If you fail at school, you'll end up at the brothel. You know, if you fall on hard times, you know, just go suck some dick at the brothel. That's what it's like for women and girls who live in red light districts. And that's why rich people would never want to have the obvious brothel next door, not for their kids or their wives. That's why it's always in the poor part of town. And no one can tell me like this is some kind of charity for poor communities and we need to give them prostitution because it'll alleviate their distress, when it adds this harassment, the presence of organized crime, the presence of drugs to their lives that they already, many of these communities already struggle with.
What are some of the options that women have for exiting the industry, should they want to? Is there any kind of support system that's set in place in Germany?
I think we can say it has slightly improved over the last few years, but that's mostly because there's been a movement growing saying we need this. Look, it's not a job like any other. And there's been a few organizations that the abolitionist movement has founded. Most centrally, that's Sisters is one of the groups. They are trying to meet the, well, they're basically overrun with requests. They can't even keep up. And the other one is the Germany Prostitution Survivor Network, which is called Netzwerk. That's Network Ella, founded by prostitution survivor Huschke Mau. Many of her blog posts are available in English, so anyone who's interested should absolutely read her blog. They try and develop programs. They're trying to get, if you donate your money, they invest it in things like safe houses, getting help, accessing social security, all the different things that women need. And they were founded specifically because there is a huge lack. The government in Germany finances programs for women in prostitution, but nearly all of them completely buy into sex workers' work ideology, which almost inevitably goes hand in hand with harm denial. So some of these actually have programs to help women enter prostitution, not get out. They're like, we'll help you get it to an especially reputable brothel rather than a shady one. So it's like, it all sounds very well-intentioned, but you're still saying, you know, the best solution to your distress is entering a brothel rather than trying and find something else.
All right. So you're saying that if a woman wants to exit, the policymakers or whoever she goes to see, if they believe the sex work is work line, they will try to transfer her.
Okay. To be 100% clear, if There are programs for women who have not yet entered prostitution, and they're saying, we'll figure out the safest way for you to enter, rather than say, we'll figure out how you don't have to enter, which is what they should do, in my opinion. And for some women who want to get out, they have suggested, instead of going to a brothel, you can go and put you in touch with this old people's home, and you can, you know, be the prostitute for the disabled men or the men with Alzheimer's, which has all kinds of ethical concerns associated with it that people don't want to talk about. You'll do, you know, prostitution light or something. Yeah, because their interest is not getting women out, because there's really this belief among some of the pro-prostitution lobby that even the suggestion of an exit program is stigmatizing, because you're saying women don't have agency and you're being paternalistic and you're being a savior. So, and unless the woman is screaming for help, but even then, we have multiple survivors in our movement who said, I went to one of these organizations and said, I need help to get out. And they said, oh, just stop going to the brothel. Like, what's the issue? They didn't even have, a script, a response, a plan for her. And these are government-funded organizations. And I've read some of the reports of these organizations, and their own reports state that the women they meet in prostitution are vulnerable. It doesn't fit their image of the empowered, self-sufficient woman at all. Like, women who don't speak German, lots of migrant women, addicted women, they talk about it. They always consistently call them sex workers and talk about agency, even when there's so evidently very little of that happening there. It's quite amazing how you can be a social worker in touch with such a vulnerable population and still really maintain that ideology.
What is the disconnect that's happening there, do you think?
It's hard for me to understand. I can only speculate. It could be that you believe in the inevitability of prostitution, and the only way to cope with that seeming inevitability is to harm denying your own mind and to say it's not that bad, and like we're giving them condoms and they're feeding their families at least for some time. Isn't that better than not having prostitution? I'm not 100% sure how that works, because the moment I started taking a closer look, I couldn't follow this anymore. I mean, I used to believe that as a teenager because it was fed to me, but it broke apart the moment I took a closer look. It's hard for me to conceive how that doesn't happen for social workers in that area, but it does. And the most upsetting thing I found is I looked at some of these NGOs or programs targeted at sexually exploited minors as teenagers and children, and their rhetoric is almost identical to the ones who are supposed to help adults. They're also about, you know, we give them condoms, and I should say, I'm really not against harm reduction. Of course, everyone involved should get condoms. It's better to have condoms than not have them, but they don't want to talk about the sex buyer and in his role, because he's the reason that condoms are not being used. It's not like the seller doesn't want to use them. And I have blog posts on this as well with the kids. It's so scary. They're not only are a lot of these organizations calling children sex workers, even though that's not technically legal, they do that. They also talk about, but some kids have more agency than others, and you know, not all of the kids are trafficked. That is really the scariest part. Like, you can see an exploited child and still maintain that it's not the same as being raped by your stepfather because there's payment. Somehow it's a different type of crime when an adult man rapes a child when there's payment. And the child may have superficially, if you look very, very superficially, put themselves in quotation marks in that situation. That's a rabbit hole. I know it's very hard to believe, but the normalization of adult prostitution very subtly normalizes the exploitation of children as well. There's really a belief that payment makes the difference between what's rape and what's some kind of sexual service, or somehow a different from rape. That part is super concerning, and it's not unique to Germany at all. It happens in New Zealand. The government in New Zealand has literally referred to children as sex workers. It happens in many NGOs around the world.
I don't know if you saw the news about the Prostasia Foundation. That's an organization that was recently advocating on behalf of what they called minor attracted people. And they advocate for the use of, I don't even like saying it, but child sex dolls, basically dolls that resemble children to enact rape. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem so far-fetched that that's where that logic would take you to, because in the first place, you're abolishing the notion of consent anyway. If consent is something that is not internally decided and driven, but is externally coerced, then that leads to no boundaries about age either. I mean, that just seems to go along with it. That's horrific. What organizations can we support? What organizations need our support? Is there a way to donate to shelters or groups that are working to help women exit the industry?
The two organizations I mentioned, Sisters is one of them. And all they do is exiting support for women in the sex trade. And they don't have government funding yet. The goal is to get that one day. Obviously, right now, they completely rely on donations. And they're building groups in different cities. So these are a lot of volunteers. Like, a lot of these people, it's not their full-time job. It's social workers and healthcare workers and just general volunteers or lawyers, all the different things that women need. Coming together. And it was also founded together with the prostitution survivor Hushka Mal. So it was on the initiative of prostitution survivors saying, we didn't find the kind of support program we need, so we're just going to make it ourselves. And they work very closely with the survivor network, Netzwerk Ella, Netzwerk Ella is survivors only. And some women who are still in prostitution either need help transitioning out. So they, for example, they They offer peer support, right? Because sometimes the best person to talk to is someone who's been in your shoes. They will use donations to pay off women's debts, because like I said, some women are kept in prostitution through debt bondage. They are tax and debt to the state. So our own state, in our opinion, is literally a pimp, because how could the state be the barrier to a woman exiting prostitution? But that can happen in a legal system. And they will also help the women who want to become activists, who want to speak out. They will help them with anything they need. Some women need, you know, to work on disguises, because it's still incredibly stigmatized to be a prostitution survivor. These women go through so much harassment for speaking out, so much victim blaming, so much, but you chose this and you're just a nympho in denial and all these terrible things. So women need to pay for, you know, realistic looking wigs, for example. They need the travel expenses. Obviously, many, many women need trauma therapy, because you don't want to exit prostitution and immediately go into activism. That can actually be quite harmful for you when you still have healing to do. So whatever she needs, they are trying to provide it. And both of these organizations always need donations, because it's, unfortunately, there's an endless list of women who need these services, and there's never enough.
I'm just struck by something that you said in another one of your videos on your YouTube channel. It was a comment you made about when activists or feminists that are sometimes referred to as liberal feminists argue that, for example, the Nordic model, which we mentioned earlier, were put in place, then it would drive the sex trafficking underground or into the shadows. And something that you had said that I thought was very poignant or very notable was that you said it exists in twilight. It always exists in a twilight, because it's half in the light, because it's public, but the element of violence, of organized crime, of degradation is the part that's always in the shadows, so that it can't be made safe for women because it relies on their exploitation in that way.
I think the point that you just made is one of the most important to understand. Like, for a long time, I wondered, is there a way to reform prostitution? Could we separate it into ethical, unethical, and help those who want to get out, and the other ones could be reasonably safe? And it just doesn't happen, because very simply, the sex buyers and the pimps don't care. They don't make that distinction in their minds. Like, these women want to be there and these women do not. And the women who do not, oh no, we won't touch those, or we won't touch the money that is made off of them. They don't make that distinction at all. And how could they? Because trafficking always disguises itself as voluntary prostitution. When you go online on the prostitution advertising websites, nearly every ad says, "Hi, I'm Stella. I love sex. I want to get down with you." These ads are all the same. How could you possibly tell who is and isn't a trafficking victim? That could be, or an addicted woman or whatever, because I really hate reducing the women who don't have a choice to just the trafficked ones, because like I said, there's other types of coercion. But it's impossible for the sex buyer. Hushka Mao always emphasizes this. How can the sex buyer know whether he's committing a rape? The truth is that he can't, and the chances are very high that he is. So which man who respects women, who wants to live with them as equals, would take a reasonable risk of raping somebody? And it's, again, the problem that we think once he has paid, he doesn't have responsibility. That's really at the heart of everything. And I really hope more people, when they look at countries like Germany, can see that this is a system that can't be reformed, because it doesn't want to be. It thrives on coercion. It requires coercion. It requires men not caring about women's well-being. That's at the heart of it. So cannot be reformed out.
You know, there are so many factors involved. Obviously, it's very complex, but when we think about what it is that's driving the motivation to do this to women, you know, there's different perspectives that you can take. Of course, power being one of them. But for example, I tend to think about the money that's involved. You had mentioned a little bit earlier about the taxes or the kind of economic incentive of Germany to basically legalize the sex trafficking of women. What would you say you think might be kind of the fundamental motivation that we need to talk about more?
I think money is certainly a big one. As you can see with Germany, once we're as invested as we are, we now have huge amounts of taxes. Like some women are paying, they pay daily taxes, and I don't want to give the wrong number, but something like 30 euros a day. And the state justifies it by saying, oh yeah, they'll just at the end of the year do their taxes and get the money back. Yeah, the illiterate Romanian women will for sure do that. We are like now economically intertwined with it, as are other countries like Thailand, for example, famously, where prostitution is illegal, but still flourishing and makes up a huge part of the GDP. You have business investors in it, like just regular business investors who would otherwise invest in, you know, a company or a grocery chain, now invest in brothel chains. None of them want to move out of this business. Once you have entangled your economy with prostitution, it's going to be difficult to untangle, because what abolitionists are asking, instead of taking money off women, we want you to invest in them. And it's unbelievable that this is considered a right-wing position, you know, a prudish right-wing position, that that's what we're asking. So money is a huge thing, but I mean, this is tricky, and I think maybe gets to the heart of some feminist theory of like conflicts, for example, between radical feminists and socialist or Marxist feminists. We have a lot in common. We agree with each other. I appreciate so much Marxist and socialist feminism. I'm really learning a lot from the ones in the past and the ones in the present, and we organize together all the time. But their idea is that when capitalism ends, prostitution will too. And I'm not so sure. And a lot of the women I talk to are not so sure that if we really, even if we did alleviate poverty, which is a huge driver, that the other ones wouldn't still be so strong that you could continue a sex trade, maybe not of equal proportions, but a big one, that things like the lover boy method, the abuse, the telling women, this is what you're good for. I think that's at the heart of prostitution, maybe even more than the money and the poverty aspect, keeping women in their place, keeping women in conflict with each other. The wife at home, the woman in the brothel are supposed to hate each other. The non-prostitute women talk bad about the so-called, many of them say to each other, the wives at home, they're so naive, right? We know the truth about men. Men come to us and show us their real face. I'm simplifying, of course, there's thankfully solidarity between women, or that's what we hope to overcome through feminism. But the idea is keep women divided, keep women fighting each other, fighting over men, wondering what's wrong with the stupid wife at home, what's wrong with the stupid hooker, right? Instead of thinking, what's wrong with men that they want to categorize women like this? They want to put them into roles like this. They like degrading them like this. And it's difficult. I'm not 100% sure how many men know exactly what they're doing. I don't think patriarchy is always conscious, but a lot of it is maybe more than we want to admit, because it's just painful to admit that someone, that a large group of men would be destroying a large group of women on purpose. But I don't think certainly the sex buyers who do it often, who keep going back to the brothel, I don't believe that they have never seen something wrong, that they don't know what they're contributing to. Because sooner or later, they'll see a woman in distress. They'll see someone who is evidently a pimp. So I don't believe that anyone who's gone to the brothel more than a few times can truly be in ignorance. I know people are quite powerful at lying to themselves, but not really. I think what happens is that he reduces the woman in the brothel to, yeah, not a person, but a thing. And that way he can keep doing it. And I'm in continuous conflict how much appealing to men's empathy can help. I do think men need to talk to each other to break through this, like not celebrate it. Don't go on the stag party where they go to the brothel. Tell your bro that this isn't cool. This is not how you want to relate to women and girls in the world, but I'm not 100% sure how to get there. And it's very difficult and painful to look all these dynamics in the eye, but obviously that's the only way to start breaking through them.
Thanks again for tuning in. Once again, my name is Genevieve Gluck. You can find me on Twitter at Women Read Women, or on Substack at genevievegluck.substack.com.